For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB. I'm your host Red Sail, and coming up today, we're celebrating World Book Day and International Women's Day. Richard Herring discusses The Problem with Men, his new book about toxic masculinity, and reveals the extra features available in the audiobook version. Deborah Frances White tells me about turning the Guilty Feminist podcast into a best-selling audiobook, and we take a look at some of the terrific titles available to younger listeners this World Book Day. That's all coming up in today's Read On. But first, here's Robert Kirkwood.
International Women's Day is a global day celebrating the social, economic, cultural and political achievements of women. Marked annually on March the 8th, it's one of the most important days of the year to celebrate women's achievements, raise awareness about women's equality, lobby for accelerated gender parity and fundraise for female-focused charities. But on International Women's Day, comedian Richard Herring noticed that a lot of men were making the same joke, "Oh, when's it going to be International Men's Day?" So he decided to answer them. Every single one.
In all seriousness, when is it International Men's Day?
Really? Seriously?
It's November the 19th.
In doing so, he's raised hundreds of thousands of pounds for charity Refuge. And in his new book and audiobook, The Problem with Men, Richard expands on his Twitter discussions and tackles some of the big questions surrounding the problems of toxic masculinity. For women, but also for men, including, is society sexist against men? And could you win a point against Serena Williams? Spoiler, the answer to all of these is no. Richard will join me in a moment, but first, let's hear a clip.
These Wazzocks, who dare to rise above the parapet to proclaim unwise and unpopular opinions for no reason other than they think they should, are the most oppressed minority in the modern world. I've been one of their main oppressors, and that's why I feel so guilty. Which is why I'm proposing making March the 9th, which is International Women's Boxing Day, if you will, International Wazzocks Day, a day set aside for all the men who ask when's International Men's Day on International Women's Day. For that one day, they're allowed to ask when's International Men's Day, and no one is allowed to mock them or call them stupid or point out that there is an International Men's Day and it's on November the 19th.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show, or as the cool kids are calling it, ROTAS.
ROTAS.
Now, joining me now is secret stone clearer, self-playing snookerist, comedian and author Richard Herring. Now, Richard, we're going to broadcast this on or around International Women's Day.
Ah, yes.
My question to you is, when will there be an International Men's Day?
I can't imagine they'd ever have one. It wouldn't be allowed due to political correctness gone mad. I think I know the date of this one. I think it might be November the 19th.
You've been answering that question on Twitter for the best part of a decade. And lastly,
yes.
You've raised a lot of money doing it. But how did it start?
Just through usual social media, avoiding work and being bored. Every International Women's Day, you would find a lot of men usually tweeting, when's International Men's Day? As if there wasn't one, and thinking they were coming up with a brilliant point. I think I sort of idly started responding to them and letting them know there was one, which that no one seemed very happy about having asked the question and not thought to Google it. So, just as a comedian, it's sort of funny to see a failed joke. And it's funny to point out a failed joke. And this is not a good joke because obviously they think they're being clever and saying that political correctness would never allow us to have an International Men's Day. But it does allow it. It's just nobody seems to want to celebrate it, which is, what as the years went by, I sort of started thinking more about why that was. And then obviously it culminated in writing a book about it, which was sort of a good way to put a full stop on it for me, because I'm not going to do it anymore for the sake of my sanity.
Did it become a sort of millstone round your neck a wee bit?
Yeah, it was. So basically within a year or two, I decided to try and find everyone asking the question and answer every single one of them, which was, the joke again was that was a ridiculous thing to do for me and an impossible task. And it was sort of setting myself up to fail because I knew I wouldn't, I probably wouldn't be able to reach everyone. But that's very much how my mind works, is thinking, well, maybe I can wipe this out. Maybe if I respond to every single person who asks it, that eventually everyone will know there is one. And so, yes, it became just year by year, it became a sort of grueling 24 to 36, sometimes 48 hours of going around the world as the clock went around the world and people started asking the question, and sometimes became a bit unpleasant. And, you know, I was sort of obviously trolling myself as much as they were trolling as well. So it was sort of, you know, I was putting myself out there and butting in on people's lives who didn't know who I was. So it was a sort of slightly passive aggressive thing to do. But really, I was mainly only answering the question they'd asked. So, you know, it was sort of, there was a sort of this element that I could sort of say I was being polite, while I was also was taking the mickey out of them and out of myself as well, out of my compunction to do it. But it didn't get better. If anything, I think, as I sort of discuss in the book, I think it was sort of the early signs. When's International Men's Day is sort of the soft drug that leads on to all the stuff we've seen over the last 10 years and people getting more and more kind of affronted at the idea that somebody else is getting special treatment without really understanding that you have special days in order to raise awareness of things, or you have Black History Month in order to raise awareness of the fact that Black history isn't really covered in schools or whatever and in the media. So you don't need a White History Month. Whether you need an International Men's Day, again, is something I discuss in the book, but it's not like having a day is even that special. But what's interesting is, you know, all the people who asked this question weren't interested in actually celebrating the day that they were sort of annoyed to furious didn't exist. So when International Men's Day comes along, if men put half the effort they put into asking when it is on International Women's Day, it would be the biggest day of the year. In recent years, I've tried to try and shift the focus a little bit. Last year, I tried to get men, well, everyone to celebrate a man who meant something to them on International Men's Day. And that was a much nicer day than International Women's Day, because it was a positive thing, you know. And I think that's sort of an interesting journey for me as well, in that, you know, I was taking part. It was a negative thing on the day that I was trying to wipe out, because I would like people to celebrate women on International Women's Day, whilst appreciating the irony I was going on about International Men's Day and International Women's Day as a result of this. But actually using the proper day to celebrate men is a much better way of doing it. And it was quite a moving day. If we can allow men to be sensitive and allow men to be celebrated, then hopefully men will allow women to celebrate their own day and strive for equality. And if you think men aren't equal, then striving for equality will also sort that out as well. So it's like equality sort of works.
Now, the problem with men is out now in print and ebook and audiobook as well. What kind of extras do we get with the audio version?
Quite a lot of stuff. I did a very long interview with Deborah Francis White, who does the Guilty Feminist podcast, because she's always a very good value to talk about feminism. My book is sort of a little bit about feminism. It's about sort of meeting in the middle and trying to work out why some people seem to be worried about the idea of equality, and whether it's just the name or whatever. So it was good. There's a big long interview with her, which I think is very good. But there's a stand-up routine that I did about this subject. And there's also some extra content. There's a very fun chapter about whether men can, whether any man could take a point off Serena Williams at tennis, and about a quarter of men think they might be able to, or don't know if they'd be able to, which is, you know, is not as many men who are professional tennis players, so it seems unlikely. And that has led to further correspondence on Twitter, so I've included some of that. And there's a few extra asides and things. I think it's quite interesting to, the audiobook's my favoured format for it, I think, to listen, because I think it's a bit like, I realise when I listen back to it, it's sort of like my 2020 stand-up show. It wouldn't take much to turn that audiobook into a stand-up show. And it's basically, in a year where we weren't allowed to go out to perform, I realised that was the show that I wrote and performed once, and it goes out as an audiobook. So I think it's nice. I listen to lots of audiobooks because I have kids now, so it's very difficult to read. So actually sit down and find time to read. So when I'm doing the dog walks and stuff, I'll try and listen to books. And it's my preferred way of listening to nearly everything.
What have you been listening to recently?
I've listened to Mary Beard's SPQR. I'm listening to Bernardine Evaristo's Booker Prize winning book, though I forget the title of that.
Girl, Woman, Other?
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, the weirdly, you kind of, because when you've not got the book in your hands, you're not reminded of sometimes who wrote it and sometimes what it's called. I have lots of authors on my podcast, so I often listen to their books. I really enjoyed Adam Buxton's audiobook last year. I think he put in a lot of effort to making that a very, very good audiobook. And it's fun when they do that. I like it when it's the author is reading it. Although I did enjoy Richard Osman's one, which is read by Leslie Manville, who is absolutely excellent as well. So it's a difficult thing to get right, because I think if you don't have a reader the person reading it who's engaged with it, or if it's a very long book. It's a difficult thing to do. My books, like I say, are like 2 hours long maybe, but it took best part of 2 days to record even that. I kind of like those sort of short form history podcasts where you get half an hour about something or an hour about something. And actually Greg Jenner's You're All Dead to Me is fantastic. And Dan Snow's stuff is always interesting. And Al Murray's doing stuff. So there's lots of great podcasts out there, which I think are, you know, just because they're generally a bit more of a conversation, or they're a bit more entertaining and a bit more easy to digest on a walk. But yeah, it's sort of life changing because I'd stopped reading very much, especially once the kids were born, but even before. And, you know, to be able to get through a book every month or two is at least something. It's one of those pleasures that's slightly been taken away for the pleasure of parenthood.
Now, one question from your podcast is, having a classic audiobook read by the original author, what are some good answers you've had to that one?
Michael Palin chose, I think, was going for like some of the Roman writers, which I think was interesting because he would like to hear how you know, Ovid or whoever spoke, which I think is quite interesting. I think that's kind of a nice way to go, to sort of hear it would be interesting to hear something that far back in history, even just to find out how Romans spoke at all, I suppose, would be quite interesting, because I don't think anyone's quite clear about accents or anything like that. But, I mean, that was my favourite answer to that. I'm trying to think of it. What other...
Somebody said Charles Dickens.
Well, Charles Dickens would be quite... I would like to hear Charles Dickens, because obviously he did perform a lot of his books as well. So he sort of did the audio books in theatres, didn't he, around that time. I don't know if any of that was ever... There possibly must have been a crossover with some audio recording at some point, some scratchy tin form. But I don't know if we've got Dickens's voice, probably not. But yeah, any of that. I mean, that's the thing. Any of those guys that from before... things were recorded, you know, I'd love to hear. I mean, Chaucer would be interesting to hear how much humour there was meant to be in those books, because Terry Jones wrote an excellent book about the Knight's Tale being a sort of satire rather than meant to be taken seriously. So it'd be interesting to hear Chaucer or Ben Jonson reading his own plays. Henry Fielding, I was a big fan of, you know, he's very funny, yes, still, I think. It's very hard for comedy to translate over even decades, I think, as we're seeing now, you know, stuff from 10 years ago doesn't fit the bill now for various reasons. And so it's quite an impressive thing when something's 50, 100 or 200 or 300 years old and still getting a laugh.
When is International Men's Day?
November the 19th.
Wait, for real? I had no idea. Thanks for the response.
So few of them thank me, but that's what makes my job worthwhile.
So the problem with men, when is International Men's Day and why it matters, written and read by Richard Herring, is available wherever you get your audiobooks. And Richard will be back at the end of the show with the books of his life.
Thanks to Richard Herring and to Robert Kirkwood.
The current times can be especially challenging for people with sight loss.
For dedicated advice, support, or to access our free talking books and reading services, call RNIB's helpline on 0303 123 9999.
The helplines open 8 till 8 on weekdays and Saturdays from 9 till 1.
Standing with you through every challenge. RNIB. See differently.
You're listening to Read On, your one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. Coming up later, we explore the accessible books on offer through RNIB for World Book Day 2021. But before that, as Richard Herring mentioned in his interview, writer and comedian Deborah Francis White is best known as the creator and host of The Guilty Feminist. The award-winning podcast considers the quandary of being a successful feminist when surrounded by the temptations and distractions of the 21st century. Here's an interview that I recorded with her on the publication of her book, of The Guilty Feminist, which she also narrated. Welcome to Read On.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, why are you The Guilty Feminist?
Well, The Guilty Feminist started as a podcast, and some of your listeners may know it. It's a podcast about our noble goals as 21st century feminists, but our hypocrisies and insecurities which undermine those goals. So basically, it's like exfoliating our guilt away and laughing about it and saying it doesn't really matter. Or if it does matter, it is serious. Like, let's look at it, put it on the table, work on it, build muscle. So we admit things at the top, like true things like, I'm a feminist, but one time I went to a women's rights march And I popped into a department store to use the loo. And when I was in there, I got distracted trying out face cream. And when I came out, the march was gone. So I went, okay, just going to run on the march. Next time, I want to make it further. And I suppose I thought, oh, my goodness, I'll get this. Feminists will kick me out of the club if they hear my confession. But actually, I discovered that so many other women and men who identify as feminists and, of course, non-binary people said, yes, I also do this. Sometimes I feel a bit claustrophobic at a march and I leave, or sometimes I feel I should be watching this four-hour documentary about the suffragettes, but in fact, I flip over and watch Say Yes to the Dress. Finding those things funny and confessing them means that we can let it go, as opposed to sort of secretly holding on to it and thinking, I don't think I'm a good enough feminist then to speak up at that meeting and say, hey, guys, this isn't right, or advocate for people who may not be in the room. And one thing that the podcast is really strong on is not just saying when white, straight, cis, non-disabled women have as many rights and advantages and as much representation as white, straight, cis, non-disabled men, then we're sorted. That's not the case at all. We really need to be advocating for each other. And it's really important that white women are constantly saying, hold on a minute, there's no women of colour on this panel. Why not? You know, we need to get somebody here. We need to have representation. Or for feminists to be saying that this building that we're having this meeting is inaccessible. How are disabled people going to feel it's possible to come if it's not accessible, or if we haven't thought about that? So the podcast is really, over the time of I've been doing it, which is 2.5 years, I've learned so much from our guests who are women of colour or from the LGBTQ community or are disabled feminists about how I can be a better feminist and think outside my own experience and understand that there are people who have far fewer advantages than I do and I need to be advocating and allying for them.
And that actually brings me on to my next question, which was going to be, what do you think disabled groups can learn from feminism? But presumably it's the inclusivity, and maybe actually that blind charities should talk to deaf charities, who should talk to learning difficulty charities.
Sure. I mean, it's the thing with disability, you know, it's not a culture, because every group that seeks to represent people with a certain disability has completely different challenges, you know, from other groups. But you're right, you know, working together. I think essentially feminism is a demand for inclusion. Feminists need to be advocating for disabled women, and also non-disabled women need to understand that they have privileges that disabled men don't have. So we very much subscribe to intersectional feminism, which means that your gender, you know, where you can be pushed into the margins because of your gender, if you watch or listen to television, you will see that there are many, many more men represented in positions of power and influence than women. But our gender intersects with disability. It intersects with race. It intersects with intersects with sexual orientation and gender identity.
So can a man be a feminist?
Oh, for sure. Feminism is just a demand for inclusion and a recognition that there is a power imbalance and a representation imbalance between men and women. If you're advocating for that gender balance to be closed, whether you're a man or a woman or you're non-binary, you are absolutely a feminist.
And have toxic men like Donald Trump and Harvey Weinstein in a perverse way helped the feminist movement by focusing attention on just how negative men's attitudes can be towards women?
I think it's centering them to say that it's helped feminism. I don't think you can ever say Harvey Weinstein and Donald Trump have helped feminism. They're the reason we need feminism. Mm. So, you know, feminism is a demand for change. It would be better if we didn't need to have such an extreme change. So, no, I don't think you can say that they've helped feminism when they're the reason we need it. But certainly, I do think that the election of Donald Trump alerted the world to the fact that it was like a jolt, it was a wake-up call, that things have been sliding further to the right for a long time. And it was sort of like punctuated equilibrium. We just suddenly went, oh my goodness, if someone like Donald Trump, who said such misogynistic things about women over the years, and the so-called locker room talk, which was so extreme, that he was recorded on that bus, and still women voted for him as well as men, admittedly largely white women, then yes, we need feminism. So I would say it did alert us to how much more urgent feminism was. And I think it's activated a lot of feminists.
Now, as far as writing the book is concerned, did you find yourself putting in different material or going more deeply into the material you had than you did with the podcast?
Totally, yeah. I was able to do a much more deep dive and really think about what I thought about feminism and construct an argument. And normally you've got a guest on, you've got a co-host, you've got a theme of the week. You know, it's a lot to juggle. And so it was great to be able to sit down with my own thoughts and do some research and rethink what I thought about feminism and why the idea of guilty feminism, which is basically the idea that we don't have to be perfect to be a force for meaningful change. It's all right to admit this week, like, I did this and this, this, but oils, I did this, this, and this. And to build muscle and to try and make yourself a stronger feminist is worthwhile. So I was able to form an argument, and really, I think the conclusion I came to when I was writing the book was feminism is not just a movement that stands against something. It's a movement that stands for something. And with this new wave of feminism, we've taken control of the means of production. Because of the internet, we're able to publish podcasts and blogs and videos, and we're able to make stuff. And what's exciting about that is, instead of just pointing at something and saying, we don't want that, we can start to create the world we do want to live in. We can become architects, not just critics. That's what's really exciting.
And I think that's something that disabled groups would like to be following in your footsteps very quickly, as far as that's concerned.
Oh, completely. Start to create the space you want to live in and try and start to be part of the new fabric. Like, we don't just have to bring a hammer to knock something down. We have to bring bricks to build something new.
Exactly.
And that's what the guilty feminist is. It's a microclimate where women do well, and women from all of these other marginalized groups that we've referenced can be celebrated. And the assumption is when they come on the show, they're going to be amazing. And the audience, live audience, cheer them. And you see the women on the podcast soar in a way that they can't if they're like one woman on a panel of six, or where everyone else is a man, or one person of colour, one person with a disability explaining what it's like to be disabled. You know, rather having a mainstream space where a bunch of different disabled people can, or a variety of blind people could say, hey, we all have these different experiences, or, oh yeah, that's a common shared experience. And they can make something fun and funny and compelling and entertaining and relatable. I mean, that's the most wonderful thing to do, rather than just sort of going into those mainstream spaces which have been designed for and by white, straight, posh men who are not disabled, and trying to sort of just sit on the end and just speak for your group. Rather, your group creates a space that other people wish to inhabit. That's the most exciting thing.
Exactly. Be proactive rather than reactive.
Exactly, yeah. It's exciting.
Now, you have helped make your book as accessible as possible by narrating it as well, haven't you?
I have. I've done an audiobook. And because I'm a podcaster and I'm a comedian, I really enjoyed performing it. And I feel like there's a sort of added element. So I feel like listening to the book, in some ways, the listeners will get more dimension. So I really hope that the audiobook is popular with everyone. So I think, you know, for your listeners, they may be getting more with the audiobook than some of the readers are getting with the print book, because, you know, my intention can be there in the way that I tell the joke. We recorded little bits and pieces of it in front of a live audience. The last chapter in front of a live audience, you're getting the audience laughing. So yeah, I think it was a really fun thing to do. And people kept saying, isn't it hard to read out a book, because it takes days to do it and it's quite tiring? And I was like, it's a lot easier reading a book than it is writing a book, let me tell you. So writing it is the hard part. Reading it out, that's the fun part.
Well, I'm very much looking forward to listening to it, as I'm sure are my wife and two daughters. Deborah Francis-White, thank you so much for being a guest on Read On, and best of luck with the book.
It's been an unqualified delight. The Guilty Feminist is available now in audiobook. I hope you enjoy it, and please tweet me at DeborahFW and tell me what you thought.
We weren't just making these confessions to our BFFs 4 margaritas into a Friday night. We were recording them for distribution. We screwed up our courage and hoped that other women identified with our inadequacies and aspirations. It turned out we weren't the only ones living with contradictions. Women responded in droves. Many have written to tell us that they'd previously felt unable to call themselves feminists, but now they knew they wanted to and could. Others said the show had acted as a valve for their guilt, a place they could laugh off things that didn't matter or that they were working on. They realised they didn't have to be perfect, or even consistent, to be a force for meaningful change. The emails I receive, which tell stories of women activated by the guilty feminist to apply for PhDs, lodge sexual harassment cases, start talking to their high school students about gender equality, or even report sexual assaults, can always be boiled down to two statements. Because I listened to the podcast, I have decided to say yes. Or, because I listened to the podcast, I have started to say no. I do not take credit for the boldness of these listeners. I think a big part of their conviction comes from hearing our live audience laughing and agreeing and commenting. It makes individual women feel like they have an army behind them when they speak up in a meeting, fill out a funding application, or tell a catcaller he's just not cool. We've had some luck with our timing. More people listen to podcasts now than go to the cinema on a weekly basis. Just when feminism was facing the onslaught of Trump, Weinstein, and the worst excesses of Twitter, people were turning to podcasts for information, inspiration, and entertainment.
The Guilty Feminist is available commercially in print, ebook, and as an audiobook that Deborah Frances White narrates herself.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB. Now, before we return to hear the books of Richard Herring's life, as many listeners, particularly those of school age, will know, March the 4th was World Book Day in the UK. World Book Day's mission is to promote reading for pleasure, offering every child and young person the opportunity to have a book of their own. Reading for pleasure is the single biggest indicator of a child's future success, more than their family circumstances, their parents' educational background, or their income. The charity wants to see more children, particularly those from disadvantaged backgrounds, with a lifelong habit of reading for pleasure and the improved life chances that this brings them. Designated by UNESCO as a worldwide celebration of books and reading, World Book Day is marked in over 100 countries. And, despite the pandemic, not only went ahead this week in the UK, but brought even greater joy than usual. Here's Robert Kirkwood with some of the highlights on offer through the RNIB Library.
World Book Day is all about celebrating the magic of books and reading. RNIB is proud to continue to support World Book Day's mission to give every child and young person a book of their own. There are 13 titles that children can buy with a £1 book token they'll receive on World Book Day. But RNIB has made these available free in audio and in braille. The books are roughly divided into age groups, nursery, primary and secondary. The first book for early readers is There's a Wolf in Your Book by Tom Fletcher. Wow, monster, dragon, alien and witch have made you a book. Jump in to explore the interactive adventure inside, but make sure you watch out for the big bad wolf.
Who's in your book? There's a cheeky monster, a cute little dragon, a slimy alien, and a clever witch. And look, they've made you a book. A book inside a book. They've even dressed up for you. Turn the page to start the story. Once upon a time, there were some little piggies. One, two, three little pigs. Alien piggy, dragon piggy, and monster piggy. Let's hope they don't meet a big, bad wolf. Eek!
There's a Wolf in Your Book by Tom Fletcher is followed by Luna Loves World Book Day. Written by Joseph Coilo, today is World Book Day and Luna can't wait. She has the whole day planned. dress up as our favourite book character, a unicorn, meet an author and illustrator, buy a new book with our book token. But disaster. Luna the Unicorn's costume has ripped. Can Dad come to the rescue with a magic potato?
Luna Loves World Book Day by me, Joseph Coilo. Mum drops Luna off at school. All of the children are dressed as their favourite book characters. There are cats and dragons, wizards and robots. Luna is dressed as her favourite book character, a unicorn. Check. In assembly, an author and an illustrator talk about their books. Their words and pictures vibrate around the hall. They read poems and stories and get the whole school to draw. Meet an author and illustrator. Check.
Luna Loves World Book Day by Joseph Coila is followed by What the Ladybird Heard by Julia Donaldson. The story play. One clever ladybird, two bungling burglars, and a whole farmyard of fun. The first story in the What the Ladybird Heard series has been adapted by author Julia Donaldson into a fun and easy-to-read play script. Perfect for reading aloud, acting out, and even putting on your very own play.
Story start. Animals take up their places in the farmyard, herded in by the farmer. Once upon a farm lived a fat red hen, a duck in a pond and a goose in a pen, a woolly sheep, a hairy hog, a handsome horse and a dainty dog, a cat that meowed and a cat that purred, a fine prize cow and a ladybird. And the cow said, "Moo," and the hen said, "Cluck." "Hiss," said the goose, and "Quack," said the duck. "Neigh," said the horse. "Oink," said the hog. "Baa," said the sheep. "Woof," said the dog.
What the Ladybird Heard, story play by Julia Donaldson. And our final young reader book is Gigantosaurus, Dinospot, by author Johnny Duddle. I've made this thing I call a book. I might let you three have a look. We'll play my game called Dinospot. To win, you'll have to spot the lot. Bonehead thinks he's the best dinospotter, but can he find a Gigantosaurus?
Gigantosaurus doesn't scare me. I'm too smart to be his tea. In fact, I'm a dino expert. I really am the best. You might know the names of some, but I know all the rest. I found these juicy berries bigger than your eyes. They do look quite delicious, and they will be our prize.
Rounding off the books for younger readers, Gigantosaurus, Dinospot by Johnny Duddle. The first book for primary-aged children is Planet Omar, Operation Kind by Zainab Mayan. One of Omar's best friends, Daniel, has a little sister who goes to hospital regularly. He usually finds it easy to cheer her up when she's there, but this time he feels he needs to do something extra special. Enter Omar and their other best friend, Charlie, to help with Operation Kind. The boys try to come up with the perfect surprise for Susie, and when they find out her favourite author is in the UK for just one day, it feels like it was meant to be. Can the boys overcome all of the ridiculous obstacles that get thrown in their path and face their fears in a race against time to get a signed copy of the book for Susie?
Ew!
That was me, complaining about the sight I was seeing. Daniel had stuck two after 8 chocolate wrappers up his nose, one in each nostril. The wrappers just smell so yummy that I had to do it. I want to smell them for ages, he explained, as if it was the most normal thing to do if you thought something smelt nice. I like the smell of strawberries, but you don't see me walking around with them up my nose, I said. That's only because they wouldn't fit. That made me explode with laughter. Sometimes Daniel can be so ridiculous.
Planet Omar Operation Kind by Zainab Mayan is followed by Protect the Planet by Jess French. Our planet is precious, and it's up to us to take care of it. You may feel small, but your small actions can make a big difference. This book will teach you that by acting with kindness towards other people, plants, animals, and yourself, you can help protect the planet.
Protective ozone. A blanket of gases many miles above Earth, called the ozone layer, stops dangerous rays from the sun reaching the Earth. This protects all living things from harm. Good for our health. When the natural system is working well, spending time in it can be really good for our physical and mental well-being. Amazing atmosphere. Gases in the air, called atmosphere, allow the right amounts of heat to enter and leave Earth. If we put too much carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, the Earth will become too hot and lead to what is known as climate change. Animal breathers. Animals breathe in oxygen and release carbon dioxide. Incredible oceans. Tiny plants in the ocean take in carbon dioxide and give out oxygen. The ocean itself absorbs heat and spreads it around the planet.
Protect the Planet by Jess French. And staying in the ecological realm with her next book, The River Whale by Sita Brahmachari. Emmy has always loved wild swimming. One day, she hopes to become a marine biologist. Tomorrow is the first step towards that goal, completing her entry-level diving certificate. But her plans for a good night's sleep are ruined by a strange and vivid dream of a distressed whale in the river. At school, she tries to shake it off, but discovers that her nightmare has leaked into reality. Emmy and her friend Cosmo must head for the Thames on a mission to save the trapped river whale.
The distant call of the chronometers now tap, tap, tapping at the tiles. Breaking time, the pool cracks open, and I'm swimming into aquamarine startling, sparkling, blue planet, ocean, light. Almost free, more whale than human, entering a bright, clean, watery world. Rainbow fish dart at my eyes. Shoals of fluorescent colour, too shimmery to be real. Drifting, floating, swirling, emerging, expelling glittering fountains, breathing in again, before returning. Moving slow and sure through wild water, in dreaming distance. Let me go into the wild. Let me swim free. But thoughts pincer into me. Please let me stay in dream time. There is nowhere I want to be more. But like it or not, I'm blasted back to the waking shore. Must prepare for diving test. Foghorn thoughts bolt me upright. If you don't pass tomorrow, maybe you never will. If I get my certificate, Clinton's got to keep his promise before he goes off travelling.
The River Whale by Sita Brahmachari. Now moving from the river to the rooftops. In Sky Steppers by Catherine Rundell. High above the streets of Paris lived the rooftoppers, a secret gang of children who eat, sleep, and tumble amongst the chimney pots. It's a perilous life, but for Mario and Mercedes, the adventure is only just beginning.
It was the evening of Matteo's 11th birthday, and he was stealing a cucumber. There were many ways in which it could have been fine, and only one in which it could have been a disaster. Unfortunately, as Matteo found, probabilities don't always play nice. He had done it many times before. If the woman behind whom he was hiding had not moved, if the two policemen had not been bored and looking for something to do, everything for the rest of his life might have been different. Instead, the woman twisted to pick up a cabbage, one of the policemen gave a sudden roar, and Matteo and the cucumber took off through the lamplit streets of Paris. He was fast, and he knew how to move through a crowd. He dodged in front of one carriage, behind another, around a man on a bicycle, who yelled something which Matteo might, in less urgent moments, have carefully memorised for later use. He ducked under the belly of a vast horse. For a second, he thought about swinging up onto it and away. But the horse was attached to the rubbish cart, and it seemed impractical.
"Stop him! Stop that boy!"
The policemen were gaining on him.
Skysteppers by Catherine Rundell. The first in our third batch of books for slightly older readers is Little Bad Man and the Radioactive Samosa by Humza Arshad and Henry White. You've heard of Little Bad Man, right? No? Oh well, doesn't matter. You will one day. He's gonna be big. 12-year-old Humza Khan, aka Little Bad Man, is amongst lots of other things, Eggington's greatest rapper, a ninja, an all-round legend. That's all according to Humza. And to be honest, Eggington, his hometown, is quite small. He has saved the world a couple of times, though, from alien slugs and evil time-travelling teachers. As we join this adventure, Humza and his two friends, Umar and Wendy, have narrowly avoided being hit by a rock from outer space. What does get hit, though, is a box of delicious samosas, which turn radioactive.
4 minutes later, we were standing in Uma's bedroom, looking down into a little cage. "Aren't they amazing?" said Uma, beaming with pride. "I really hope you're not talking about these rats," I replied, "because I could be eating popcorn and watching superheroes beating each other up right now." "They're not rats," said Uma, looking offended. "They're hamsters." They looked pretty ratty to me. They had ratty little faces, big ratty eyes, and they were crawling all over each other like, well, rats. "This is what you dragged me round here for, to check out your plague rats." "They're not rats," said Uma, rolling his eyes. "My mum said I could either have hamsters or goldfish, so it was a no-brainer, really." "I thought all your decisions were no-brainers," I replied with a grin. "Ha ha, very funny," said Uma, without actually laughing. "It doesn't really matter what you think. I know they're brilliant. I've been training them all day."
Little Bad Man and the Radioactive Samosa by Humza Arshad and Henry White is followed by Football Stories. Written by Alexander Bellos and Ben Littleton, discover 20 mind-blowing football stories in this autumn collection created for World Book Day. Find out the true stories of the star players, top teams and game changers who have shaped football history. Stories include the secret behind Lionel Messi's success, the footballer who poos on the pitch, the greatest goat in football, and the incredible story of women's football after World War I.
Friends and rivals. When he was in Barcelona's youth academy, Fatih formed a devastating strike partnership with a player from Japan called Takefusa Kubo. In one season for the under-12s, the pair scored 130 goals between them. Kubo left Barcelona, but ended up back in Spain when he signed for Real Madrid. Fati and Kubo have not let their club's rivalry ruin their friendship. Mates before teams.
Football Stories by Alexander Bellos and Ben Littleton, which is followed by Killjoy by Holly Jackson. Pippa Fitzamobi is not in the mood for her friend's murder mystery party, especially one that involves 1920s fancy dress and pretending that their town, Little Kilton, is an island called Joy. But when the game begins, Pip finds herself drawn into the make-believe world of intrigue, deception and murder. But as Pip plays detective, teasing out the identity of the killer clue by clue, the murder of the fictional Reginald Remy isn't the only case on her mind. And our final book is Skullduggery Pleasant by Derek Landy. Three ancient gods are freed from their prison with only one desire: to destroy the planet and everyone on it. To save us all, Skullduggery Pleasant and Valkyrie Kane must go undercover in a Dublin school. Skullduggery has to blend in with the teaching staff, while Valkyrie has to pass for an ordinary schoolgirl. Above all else, no matter what happens, they both must act completely and utterly normal. We are so dead.
She surprised him then by telling him something so brain-punchingly interesting that it changed his life forever. She told him, in that hesitant way of hers, that magic was real and that she was magic, and so was he. At first, he thought she was just telling him a story to entertain him. But when she clicked her fingers and conjured a fireball into her hand, it all started to make sense. The odd occurrences, the weird coincidences, the objects that moved on their own. That was magic. His grandmother explained that there were rules for people like them. There were styles of magic he could specialise in, other magical people, sorcerers or mages he could meet. She told him about the sanctuaries around the world and the wars that had been fought between the sorcerers who wanted to enslave ordinary people and the sorcerers who wanted to protect them. He had such a life ahead of him, she said. Such wonders to uncover. She taught him some things. How to move objects by manipulating the air around them. How to make strands of energy dance in the palms of his hands. How to click his fingers and generate sparks. She told him about the three names that sorcerers have: the name they're given, the name they take, and their true name, the source of all their power.
Our final World Book Day book, Skullduggery Pleasant by Derek Landy. And finally, there is one more book in the Welsh language. Here's Lynn Morgan.
Thanks, Robert. That book is Ha Ha Knek by Hugh Aron, packed with jokes and cartoons, along with some of Hugh's unique characters.
For more information, search for World Book Day, or call the RNIB helpline on 0303 123 9999, or visit rniblibrary.com.
Thanks, Robert. And you have until the 28th of May to spend your £1 book tokens. Now it's back to Richard Herring for the books of his life.
Now, Richard, is there a book from childhood that made you fall in love with reading and writing?
I mean, there are quite a lot. I wasn't a voracious reader, and I kind of pretended to read things a lot when I was a kid. I remembered pretending I'd read all of the Dr. Dolittle series, and I quite liked Dr. Dolittle, but I kind of gave, you know, we had all of them, I think, that were handed down from my brother. I did really like it. It was funny. I was into funny things all the time, and so, like, I liked TV and shows, really, and puppet shows and stuff like that. And when I got a book token for Christmas, I remember my dad being very upset that I bought Peanuts Charlie Brown book. But, you know, I was very into sort of comedy. You know, if I was lying and pretending I read books more than I did, I'd say Dr. Dolittle, which is a, it was a, you know, a fantastic idea and a great series. But I think really I probably put more towards Asterix and Peanuts and things like that that weren't proper books according to my academic parents.
It happened one day that the doctor was sitting in his kitchen talking with the cat's meat man, who had come to see him with a stomachache. "Why don't you give up being a people's doctor and be an animal doctor?" asked the cat's meat man. The parrot, Polynesia, was sitting in the window looking out at the rain and singing a sailor song to herself. She stopped singing and started to listen. "You see, Doctor," the cat's meat man went on, "you know all about animals, much more than what these here vets do. That book you wrote about cats, why, it's wonderful. I can't read or write myself, or maybe I'd write some books, but my wife, Theodosia, she's a scholar, she is, and she read your book to me. Well, it's wonderful, that's all that can be said, wonderful. You might have been a cat yourself. You know the way they think."
Dr. Dolittle, or to give it its full title, The Story of Dr. Dolittle, being the history of his peculiar life at home and astonishing adventures in foreign parts never before printed, by Hugh Lofting, is available commercially in audio and from RNIB. The RNIB version is read by David Dunhill. And is there a book that on a rainy day you go back to again and again?
I mean, I think as an adult, I mean, sadly, I'm going to go for another cartoon book. But the books that really make me laugh and the book that kind of had most influence me on me as a adult becoming a comedian is The Far Side by Gary Larson, which is, you won't have an audio book of, which is another book of cartoons, which I do go back to. And I guess Margaret Atwood's stuff is always worth going back to. And I've read The Heather Handmaid's Tale a couple of times. I've listened to the audio book and The Testaments and Oryx and Crake. And I think she's a really engaging, brilliant author. Probably my full answer, though, is going to be Slaughterhouse-Five by Kurt Vonnegut, which I haven't yet listened to on audiobook, but I've read several times. I've listened to Breakfast of Champions, which is read by John Malkovich. As John Malkovich reads it, and it's really great. He has to describe the pictures in Breakfast of Champions, which he does in a kind of wonderfully world-weary way. When she reads the whole book in this very world weary way. And that Kurt Vonnegut's my favourite author, I think, overall. Just sort of genius.
Listen, Trout and Hoover were citizens of the United States of America, a country which was called America for short. This was their national anthem, which was pure balderdash, like so much they were expected to take seriously. Oh, say, can you see by the dawn's early light what so proudly we hailed at the twilight's last gleaming? Whose broad stripes and bright stars through the perilous fight o'er the ramparts we watched were so gallantly streaming? And the rocket's red glare, the bombs bursting in air, gave proof through the night that our flag was still there. Oh, say, does that star-spangled banner yet wave? Or the land of the free and the home of the brave. There were 1 quadrillion nations in the universe, but the nation Duane Hoover and Kilgore Trout belonged to was the only one with a national anthem, which was gibberish sprinkled with question marks. Here is what their flag looked like. And here is a drawing of the American flag, the Stars and Stripes.
John Malkovich reading Breakfast of Champions by Kurt Vonnegut, which is only available from Audible. The Kurt Vonnegut books Slaughterhouse-Five, Cat's Cradle and Bluebeard are all available from RNIB. And finally, is there a book you've read recently that you'd like to recommend?
I read Craig Brown's book about the Beatles, 1, 2, 3, 4, I believe it's called, and it, absolutely excellent, you know, with the subjects that's been covered so massively over the years to find new stuff. It's almost like reinventing the biography because it sort of whizzes around the periphery of the Beatles and you find out little bits about the lives of the people that touched their lives and who in turn had their lives touched by the Beatles. So you find out little bits about Jane Asher's dad and stuff like that. And then, but you know, people who the songs were based on. And so it's a really fun book, which is also, you know, there's a bit about Craig Brown going to see the Beatles houses and being quite funny about the people doing the tours and how precious they are about all the information that they're giving out, which is all generally quite well-known information. And he gets into sort of like a little fight with one of them because he's recording the talk. So it's a very unusual book, but it was absolutely, you know, and it's quite a long book and I kind of whizzed through it in a week. I was away working on a film, so I had lots of time to read. And it just sort of filled up the time I was waiting to be on camera. And really good, really enjoyable. And even if you've read everything about the Beatles, I think there'll be stuff in there that you won't have thought about. And there's a bit where Paul McCartney, after Hamburg, Paul McCartney went back and worked in a factory and got offered a kind of middle management job and had to weigh up whether he was going to take that or go back and play in the Cavern with the Beatles at lunchtime. And he couldn't do both. And just kind of really fascinated by the idea of Paul McCartney making the other decision and how his life would have panned out if he'd made that choice. I think he made the right choice.
In the autumn of 1969, Paul began to feel nostalgic for the days when the Beatles were at their happiest. He felt that the only way to restore their lost sense of camaraderie was to go back on the road, turning up unannounced to play small halls in out-of-the-way places. I thought, that's what I miss, and what they miss too, playing. He mentioned his plan to Ringo and John. Ringo appeared to go along with it, but John replied, "You're daft," adding, "Anyway, I'm leaving the group. I want a divorce."
Mark McGann reading from 1234, The Beatles in Time by Craig Brown. It's also narrated by Kate Robbins and Craig Brown. It's available commercially, and thanks to HarperCollins, it's also available from RNIB. Richard Herring, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you.
Alas, that's all we've got time for today, but Read On will be back at the same time next week. And you can always subscribe to the podcast by searching your provider for Read On, the audiobook show. And why not follow us on Twitter? I'm at RedSale, which is RedSzell, and Robert Kirkwood is at Talking_Books. Thanks to producer Hannah, to all my guests, and to you for listening. Farewell until next week, and remember to read on.